The headlines: Israel launches airstrikes on a besieged Gaza Strip amid heightened tensions following the regime's deadly raid on the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Palestinians say the Israeli raid on Nablus was part of the regime's systematic terrorism, saying the right response is resistance across the occupied territories. And Iran's leader says some hostilities toward the Islamic Republic are due to the very nature of the Islamic establishment, and others are over political issues such as Palestine. Hello and welcome, everybody. Palestinian mourners have held a massive funeral procession for the victims of the latest Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. At least 11 Palestinians, including a 14-year-old boy and a 66-year-old man, were killed in the attack. Over 100 others were injured, several of them critically. Palestinian officials have requested an emergency session of the UN Security Council on the Israeli massacre in Nablus. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement says two of its commanders are among those killed. The Israeli regime has intensified crackdown on Nablus and the nearby city of Jenin since the inauguration of the regime's far-right cabinet led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. On Thursday, 30-year-old Palestinian youth identified as Mohammad Nabil Fawzi Abu Sabah succumbed to injuries he suffered during a recent Israeli raid of a refugee camp in Jenin. More than 60 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces across the West Bank so far this year. The Israeli military has carried out airstrikes on the besieged Gaza Strip a day after killing nearly a dozen Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. There were no immediate reports of casualties and damage from the airstrikes. Our correspondent in Gaza, Asha Shannon, filled us in with more details.
Israeli fighter jets attacked two areas in the Gaza Strip between 5:30 and 6 a.m. This morning. The first location that was hit by the Israeli rockets was a Hamas training center in the west of Gaza City near the coastline. And the other one was in also a Hamas security post in Al-Burej refugee camp in the center of the Gaza Strip. The Israeli regime claims that the airstrikes were retaliation for what they said rockets that were fired from the Gaza Strip. Palestinian resistance groups, mainly Hamas's military wing, the Azim Qassam Brigades, retaliated to the airstrikes and the presence of Israeli fighter jets by firing a heavy machine gun fire towards the Israeli fighter jets. While earlier, Palestinian resistance factions, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, condemned the carnage in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus that claimed the lives of around a dozen Palestinians. The spokesman of the Azim Qassam Brigades, the Hamas military wing, Abu Ubaida, said yesterday that the Palestinian resistance factions will retaliate and will not remain silent.
Iran's foreign minister has strongly condemned the latest Israeli massacre of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus.
The Zionist regime is facing multifaceted crises from within, and Netanyahu's cabinet is falling apart. Israel has resorted to bloodshed to cover up these crises, but what was witnessed in Nablus proved that resistance is not limited to Gaza alone. The entire West Bank has now turned into an epicenter of resistance against the occupying regime.
Amin Abdullahian's remarks came as condemnations are pouring in over the Israeli bloodshed of the Palestinians. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah said the cruel targeting of civilians confirms that the occupying regime can only be deterred by the weapon of the resistance fighters. In a message, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shataya branded the Nablus carnage as the Israeli regime's systematic terrorism. A separately resistance movement Hamas denounced the extrajudicial killing of Palestinians, saying that retaliatory attacks would be the only right response to Israel. Well, to further look into the recent Israeli aggression against Palestinians, we're now joined by Mona Kandil, who's with us from Ramallah. Also, we have activist and political commentator Laith Maruf, who's with us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mona in Ramallah, please bring us up to speed on the aftermath of the recent deadly Israeli raid that took place in the city of Nablus yesterday.
Not only the city of Nablus, we can say all the occupied West Bank cities are witnessing a day of anger and a sad day after the massacre that was carried out in Nablus, leading to the martyrdom of 11 Palestinians in Nablus alone, including three elderly over the age of 60. What happened yesterday is that Israeli forces raided Nablus city, claiming that they want to arrest or kill Palestinian fighters who are accused of being part of the Palestinian resistance or planning to carry out a number of anti-Israel operations. They surrounded a building there. They clashed with Palestinians inside it. And at the end of the day, they left the city after killing 11 Palestinians and wounding over 100 Palestinians. Today, a general strike, a day of anger, had been declared across the occupied West Bank with no schools, no transportation. Maybe, let's say, it's a way of expressing Palestinian sadness and anger amid calls from the Palestinian resistance groups for the Palestinians to go to the areas where Israeli military checkpoints are located. And there's a clear call to clash with the Israeli forces. Up till the moment, no, let's say, protests and demonstrations have taken place today, but it's a general strike, a day of anger. Palestinian resistance groups have vowed to respond to the killing of those 11 Palestinians in Nablus. And we have to mention that with the martyrdom of 11 Palestinians in Nablus, since the beginning of this year, 17 Palestinians were killed in Nablus alone, with dozens others had been killed in the occupied West Bank and in Al-Quds.
Right. Laith Maarouf, I want to get your perspective on the recent escalation of the Israeli violence against Palestinians. In addition to that also, I want to get your views on the response that we've been seeing from not just various countries, but also from the Palestinian Resistance Front, Hamas, Islamic Jihad. They've stated that the Israelis will see the consequences of the increasing of their aggression and their crimes. Are we on the cusp of a third intifada?
Well, look, everybody's playing right now a waiting game because, for instance, yesterday, the former prime minister of the Zionist colony, Lapid, stated that the economy of Israel will collapse in 6 months, that there will be a civil war within that 6 months in Israel. So what we see is that the resistance axis knows that there is a huge possibility of this internal collapse and civil war in Israel. And so they are trying to be patient and allow those things to roll out. At the same time, Netanyahu and his ilk know that, and they have their only way to avoid a civil war inside Israel and an internal collapse of the colony is through either creating a war with the Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza and Jerusalem, and or trigger a wider regional war. The threats increase to the Islamic Republic of Iran, and also yesterday, as we saw, the Israelis shelled South Lebanon, hitting a home under construction and a few farmlands in between the houses in a village in the south of Lebanon. So the Zionists are attempting in any way possible to externalize their contradictions within the state of Israel, to create a war that could distract the contradictions within their own colony.
Let's go back to Mona. Mona, what can you tell us about how Palestinians feel about the international silence, a lack of proper response as we see these crimes continuing? Specifically, they've been escalating not just this year, but over the past several months.
Since the beginning of 2023, 64 Palestinians have been killed across Palestinian territory. And what the Palestinians are receiving are only condemnation from the international community. It's not enough for the Palestinians. Condemnation is okay, but they need from the international community to translate their statements into acts on ground. Israel must be, Israeli soldiers and Israeli military officials must be persecuted for the crimes. This is what the Palestinians want. Several cases had been taken to the International Criminal Court to bring Israeli criminals into justice to be prosecuted, but nothing is going on. What the international community is doing is condemning Israeli crimes, at the same time condemning Palestinian acts of resistance, as if equaling between the victims and the criminals. It's not accepted for the Palestinians, so that's why they are fed up. They also want, and they consider it could be a good position from the Arab states. They want an immediate stop of the normalization of relations. Palestinians are demanding that at least Arabs should stop all acts of relations with the Israeli regime, and a more serious action from the international community. But at the end of the day, as long as the Israeli regime feels it's supported and backed by the American administration, then they would continue to act as a state above the law. They would continue to act their crimes against the Palestinians, knowing that nothing would happen against them.
All right, thank you, Sampater. Laith Maruf joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, and Ismona Kandil joining us from Ramallah. Elsewhere, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says some bare animosity toward the Islamic Republic over its political stance, such as on the question of Palestine. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, however, that some hostilities are due to the very nature of the Islamic establishment. He said the Islamic Republic is opposed to those who believe in the West's policy of separating religion from social issues. He added Iran is also against the liberal democracy advocates who plan to loot the riches of the world in the name of freedom and democracy. The leader noted that Iran has thwarted such schemes by creating a nexus between democracy, freedom, and religion. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei urged caution against the enemy's plot of striking despair into the hearts of people. The leader further hailed the huge turnout of people in nationwide rallies marking the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The Yemeni government has strongly condemned what it calls the United Nations' insidious plans to divide Yemen and the rest of the Middle East into smaller states subservient to Western imperialism. Yusuf Maori reports from Sana'a.
The UN Special Envoy to Yemen, Haines Grunberg, has been busy this week meeting with Yemeni and UAE officials in the Emirates. The UN Envoy's office posted a tweet stating that the latest efforts are aimed at improving Yemen's living conditions and securing longer-term peace, security, and development. Given the UN's track record in Yemen, it behooves one to raise some questions about what security, peace, and development look like through the political lens of the United Nations. I visited Mohammed al-Nu'aymi, a member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, to hear his take on the UN's progress in establishing security, lasting peace, and development in Yemen.
The United Nations efforts and strategies in most of the nations they have been involved in have focused on two main efforts. The first effort is gathering intelligence for Western nations because it is the West who controls the UN. The second effort is to pave the way for Western states to implement their political agenda. For example, in Yemen, they want to control the country's political affairs and geography. If they are unable to achieve this, their second option is to divide Yemen.
Al-Nu'aymi also said the UN and its partners' political ambitions are not limited to Yemen.
They are not just planning to divide Yemen, they are planning to fragmentize the entire region, including the states that are helping them in this effort. For example, they are planning to divide Egypt into three states and Saudi Arabia into five states.
Abdel Khalik Qobar, a Yemeni judge I spoke with, said cases of war crimes should be filed against members of the United Nations, who he says are actively engaged in covering up the crimes against humanity perpetuated on Yemenis. In his televised speech last week, leader of Ansarullah movement Sayyid Abdel Malik al-Houthi called on the Yemeni people to be prepared for war in case peaceful efforts fail to bring about the Yemeni people's demands. The UN claims to be engaged in peaceful efforts to bring an end to the conflict in Yemen. However, according to Ansarullah officials, the UN body has been engaged in efforts to divide countries in the region. Officials we spoke with believe this is part of a greater plan which aims to prevent the Muslim world from uniting against Western imperialism. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with a number of elegists, eulogists, and religious poets in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on January 12, 2023. The meeting took place one day before the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha. You need to be well aware of what is taking place in the world and what is happening inside the country. For example, consider recent events. I would like to say something about the recent events in Iran. In recent events, the enemy's plot was comprehensive, but their calculations were wrong. As a person who views, monitors, and understands these issues, in my heart, I thought how well has the enemy engineered this? It was well engineered. They had prepared everything in the right places and in the right amounts. So why didn't they succeed? Because one of the enemy's bases, the calculations it had made, was wrong. Yes, the things they did were all very important and effective, and they do have an impact in certain countries. However, they were unsuccessful here. This is because the calculations they had made about Islamic Iran were wrong.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I will give two or three examples of the enemy's miscalculations. I have briefly mentioned some of these in my previous talks. They imagined that because of the economic problems that exist, the Iranian nation would cooperate with the enemy's plots of subversion or regime change and separatism. This is a calculation. Their calculation was wrong. They imagine that by using foul language and insults, they would be able to take the country's officials out of the picture and make them assume a passive role. Some people become passive when they hear foul language and insults. Their calculation was wrong. They thought they could create differences of opinions among the country's high-level officials by using temptations and creating commotions. They hoped that one side would say, let's do such and such a thing, and the other side would say, no, they wanted to sow discord. This is a problem that exists in the US. It exists in the Zionist regime. It exists in some other countries too. These differences prevent them from getting big things done. They imagined they could create such differences. This was part of their calculations, but this calculation was wrong. They imagined that by using the petrodollars of a mercenary country of the US, they could weaken the Islamic Republic's determination.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A year has passed since the ongoing war in Ukraine broke out. Despite calls for dialogue and a peaceful solution to end the conflict, Western nations, particularly the US, have fanned the flames of war by sending billions of dollars in arms to Ukraine, including heavy military equipment. This trend has only escalated the conflict, and prospects for an end to the war look bleak. Also, it seems that Ukraine's allies are gearing up for a much longer war. In his first trip to Ukraine since the beginning of the conflict, US President Joe Biden met with his Ukrainian counterpart Volodymyr Zelensky. During his hours-long surprise visit to Kyiv, Biden said he was there to show his country's unwavering support for Ukraine.
And I'm here to show our unwavering support for the nation's independence, their sovereignty, and territorial integrity. And today, I hope we're going to have a chance to discuss how the United States and our allies, by keeping constant contact with them, our partners, can most effectively support you and your cause, Mr. President.
And later, at a joint presser with Zelensky, Biden promised increased arms deliveries to Ukraine.
We've committed nearly 700 tanks and thousands of armored vehicles, 1,000 artillery systems, more than 2 million rounds of artillery ammunition, more than 50 advanced launch rocket systems, anti-ship and air defense systems, all defend Ukraine. And that doesn't count the other $500 million we're announcing with you today and tomorrow.
Zelensky hailed the visit as a key sign of support, saying Russia does not stand a chance of winning the war.
Mr. President, I know that
this is an unequivocal signal that Russian attempts to win will have no chance. Together, we will protect our cities and our people from the terror of Russia.
While Biden was in Kyiv, the U.S. State Department announced a further $460 million in aid to Ukraine. The assistance includes $450 million in artillery ammunition, anti-armor systems, and air radars, as well as $10 million for energy infrastructure. Biden's visit to Ukraine was the first trip to the country by a U.S. president in 15 years. The visit came 4 days before the first anniversary of the breakout of the war between Ukraine and Russia. Moscow has repeatedly warned the West against providing Kyiv with weapons, saying it would only prolong the conflict. Now, Biden's trip has clearly sent a contradictory message to Moscow. That is, the influx of weapons to Ukraine will continue and that Washington exactly wants the war to go on. Since the beginning of the conflict in Ukraine, Western countries, particularly the U.S., have fanned the flames of war by sending arms to the country rather than supporting dialogue. Now, the U.S. has accused China of planning to send weapons to Russia in its war with Ukraine, warning Beijing that any supplies would cause a serious problem.
We have seen Chinese companies, and of course in China there's really no distinction between private companies and the state. We have seen them provide non-lethal support to Russia for use in Ukraine. The concern that we have now is based on information we have that they're considering providing lethal support. And we've made very clear to them that would cause a serious problem for us and in our relationship.
Blinken said he had made it clear to his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi, during the Munich Security Conference that Beijing would face consequences if it moved ahead with assisting Russia in the war. The warning comes as the U.S. has been the largest provider of weapons to Ukraine during the year-long war with Russia. In reaction to Blinken's comments, China rejected the accusation, saying it's the Americans who are endlessly shipping weapons to the battlefield.
It is the U.S., not China, that is providing a steady stream of weapons on the battlefield. The United States is in no position to make demands of China. We will never accept the U.S. pointing fingers at Sino-Russian relations or even cursing us.
China has expressed deep concern over the Ukraine conflict getting out of control. Beijing has also urged certain countries to stop adding fuel to the fire while pledging to promote dialogue to resolve the conflict.
There is no end in sight to the Israeli atrocities in the region. In the latest development, the regime carried out yet another airstrike near the Syrian capital, Damascus. Several people were killed and over a dozen injured. The attack heavily damaged nearby residential buildings. That after missiles hit the densely populated Kafr Susa neighborhood in central Damascus, where a security complex was located. One soldier was also said to have been killed as a result. The Syrian military said the air defense confronted what it called hostile targets in the sky around Damascus. Rights groups said the latest Israeli strike was the deadliest in the Syrian capital since last month, when another missile attack targeting Damascus International Airport left 4 people dead. The latest attack, like usual, drew strong condemnation from Damascus. The Syrian Foreign Ministry called the strike a crime against humanity. Iran and Russia separately condemned the attack. Iran's Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani slammed the West's, quote, shameful silence over repeated violations of Syria's sovereignty. Kanani called on the UN Security Council to react to the latest attack by Israel. Russia also called the assault a flagrant violation of international law. Moscow warned of what it called dire consequences for the region. The Israeli assault came days after over 50 people were killed in an ambush carried out by Daesh terror group in Syria's central desert province of Homs. Syrian media said the bodies of all victims taken to a state hospital had gunshot wounds to the head. Recent attacks carried out by the Israeli regime and the Daesh terror group come at a time when Syria is grappling with one of the deadliest earthquakes of all time in the history of the country. So far, nearly 6,000 people have died in Syria's recent earthquake. As the Syrian foreign ministry put it, at a time when Syria was trying to heal its wounds, bury its martyrs, and receive condolences, sympathy, and international humanitarian support in facing the devastating earthquake, the Israeli entity launched an air aggression targeting the civilian-populated residential neighborhoods in Damascus. Faisal Miqdad called on the United Nations Secretariat and UN Security Council to condemn the regime's aggression and hold it accountable for its crimes. Syria has been repeatedly complaining to the UN over Israeli repeated assaults, urging the Security Council to take action against Tel Aviv's crimes, but those calls have all fallen on deaf ears. The international community has failed to take a single action in at least condemning such attacks. That comes to the spotlight, especially at a time when the United States maintains its occupation of Syria's eastern oil-rich provinces to steal the country's reserves. There are reports that the Americans load tankers and trucks with oil and wheat and send them over the border to Iraq. The U.S. occupation of oil-rich Syria, the Daesh terror attacks there, and the repeated Israeli missile strikes against the Arab country all take one to the conclusion that Washington and its allies still haven't given up in trying to destroy Syria. Not only one cannot expect any condemnation from Western countries with regards to the matters, there seems to be no international community who would want to do anything. After all, their interests lie in not taking any action. All in all, what seems to be crystal clear is the fact that Syria is still being punished for stopping the plans of those who wanted to create a new Middle East. That makes it even more auspicious when countries which were once hopeful of establishing a new government in Damascus are now normalizing relations with Syria.
Protesters have returned to major cities across Europe to voice their anger at the rising cost of living across the continent. In Spain, people held a massive rally in Madrid against what they call the regional government's dismantling of the public healthcare system. Officials say 250,000 people turned out, but organizers put the number as high as a million. That is the largest such demonstration in recent months. Protesters accuse the regional government of prioritizing private health. They say the public health service is suffering from staff and equipment shortages because of the government's policies. Some primary care doctors and healthcare workers have also been holding regular strikes over better working conditions and pay.
The condition of the public health system is deteriorating. The number of doctors have been decreasing with medical conditions getting worse. Many medical centers have been closed.
The region's right-wing leader has repeatedly claimed that the protesters are motivated by political interests. And in the Portuguese city of Lisbon, tens of thousands of teachers have taken to the streets amid public discontent over the cost of living crisis. It is the third time in less than a month that teachers and school workers have held mass demonstrations. Teachers want a pay rise and are also calling on the government to speed up career progression. Officials say negotiations with teachers' unions are ongoing and expressed hope that an agreement would be reached soon. Portugal is one of Western Europe's poorest countries, which is seeing decades-high inflation and is grappling with the cost of living crisis.
We are here to claim our rights, which were taken away from us a long time ago. Our careers have been frozen for a long time, and that can't be. We have the right to have a more dignified career. We can't work like this. It just can't be.
Protests in Spain and Portugal come as passengers across Germany have witnessed widespread travel chaos after a major trade union called on airport workers to go on a strike over a pay dispute. Verdi Trade Union called for the industrial action after it said collective bargaining efforts to settle wage disputes with the government failed. Since last year, European airlines have been facing labor strife amid staff shortages and soaring inflation, which have prompted employees to demand higher wages. German officials say despite a recent improvement, the economy is expected to suffer another mild decline in early 2023, as energy prices for households are still increasing. German consumer prices, harmonized to compare with other European Union countries, peaked at 11.6% in October, driven by the surge in energy prices and rising input costs. In the UK, more than 70% of UK households fear that they will be severely hit by the cost of living crisis in the first part of 2023, up from 54% at the end of last year.
Nobody actually wants to be on strike. We want to do our jobs. We want to look after the students here. This is what our passion is. But we've been driven into a situation where we can't even pay our bills now. So basically, we've been forced to do this. Nobody works in education to be rich, but we'd like to have a decent standard of life. And I think we're losing a lot of staff as well. A lot of people are leaving because of the pay.
Meanwhile, in France, police clashed with people protesting the government's pension reform bill. Hundreds of thousands of people attended the rally, which was held in a number of other cities across France, seeking to keep up pressure on the government over the reform plan, which aims to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64. President Emmanuel Macron says the reform is vital to ensuring the viability of the pension system.
We would like the age of retirement to remain the same. 62 is already enough for working people like us. We work in kindergarten in the way, and we don't see ourselves working with children at 64. It's already quite hard currently, and going farther isn't possible.
This is a democracy, and people only have a month to debate the pension reform. The government has kept its project hidden for months, despite the fact that it was ready, and they only yield on details when people take to the streets. Well, we will keep going.
The economic crises have been compounded by the protracted war in Ukraine. The war has pushed up prices, including the price of commodities like energy products. Furthermore, European nations have pledged billions of dollars worth of military aid to Ukraine. And that has sapped the capacities of European major economies to spend money on social welfare programs.
The Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, visited China for an official three-day state visit aimed at building up bilateral ties. The Iranian president arrived in Beijing earlier on Tuesday as the head of a high-ranking politico-economic delegation on an official invitation by his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping in Beijing. Speaking to reporters before leaving Tehran for Beijing, Raisi said that Iran and China have similar views on fighting unilateralism at the international level. During the trip, the two countries sought to operationalize the Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Agreement, which was finalized in March 2021 in a bid to strengthen their long-standing economic and political alliance. The $400 billion deal will pave the way for Iran's Joining the Belt and Road Initiative, which is a massive infrastructure project stretching from East Asia to Europe. Xi and Raisi attended the signing of 20 cooperation agreements, adding to a 25-year partnership agreement to cooperate in developing oil, industry, and other fields. The two sides signed a number of bilateral cooperation documents in the fields of agriculture, trade, tourism, environmental protection, health, disaster relief, culture, and sports. The Chinese leader said Beijing opposes external forces interfering in Iran's internal affairs and undermining Iran's security and stability. And President Ebrahim Raisi said that Iran and China are friends in hard times, stressing that further strengthening of relations between the two countries will contribute to the security of the region and the world. The visit comes amid rapid geopolitical shifts in the wake of protracted Ukraine war and the end of the unipolar world order led by the U.S. and its Western allies. China is now among Iran's top trading partners. Since 2022, the 10-month figure of trade between the two nations stands at $25.3 billion. That figure has surpassed the volume of trade between Iran and its other neighboring countries, like the UAE, Turkey, and Iraq. Since March of last year, Iran imported $12.7 billion worth of goods from China, and its exports to Beijing stood at $12.8 billion. President Raisi took office back in 2021, and since then he has tried to readjust Iran's foreign policy with a focus on eastern countries, which has come to be known as the Look to the East policy. It aims to forge alliances with non-Western countries, especially China and Russia. Moreover, Iran is joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a key regional bloc where China is a co-founder. The bloc is a counterweight against U.S.-led security and economic blocs and could significantly reduce the hegemony of the U.S. in Asia. SCO member countries account for more than 40% of the world's population and contribute about 30% of the global gross domestic product, GDP. It's widely believed that Iran's close partnerships with countries like China will significantly erode Western hegemony and pave the way for a new world order.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. The Last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. Of human volition and thought.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You're listening to The Last Savior. This is your host, Zainab. I am with Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, dear listeners, as we know, to know about Imam of our time, it's really important to know about the Imam himself, and it's also important to know about his friends and foes. And some of his friends and foes have been discussed in the signs. Yes, we had been talking about the signs of reappearance, and right now we had been talking about a person named Sufyani who will rise before the reappearance of Imam. Well, Dr. Karimi, what are the goals of Sufyani, knowing about his time and place of uprising? What is his goal? What does he want?
So first of all, we are talking about a very wicked person. Such people, usually, they are looking for more power, for more dominance over different countries. And we can understand from the narrations that there are two main goals for the uprising of Sufyani. The first one is killing the Shia, and there is no doubt about that. There is one narration in this regard from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. This is an authentic narration in Al-Ghiba by Sheikh Nu'mani, chapter 18, page 311, hadith number 3. The Imam talks about two features of Sufyani, one of them being his anger and second being his hatred. Imam says that his anger and his hatred are only toward the Shia. And of course, Imam says that Shi'atana, our Shia. There is no doubt about the fact that one of the main reasons for all these merciless actions and violent actions of Sufyani in different countries, including the Shia countries, is to massacre the Shia. There are different scenarios why, Sufyani is looking for killing the Shia. In one of the previous episodes, we talked about the religion of Sufyani, whether he is Muslim or Christian or a Muslim converting to Christianity. So I'm not going to repeat that. It seems that there might be two motivations for him trying to kill and massacre the Shia. The first opinion might be that, like many Wahhabis nowadays that consider Shia as a heretic denomination, as a disbeliever, he may have the same viewpoints. We know that when it comes to ISIS, for example, they consider Shia as kuffar, as disbelievers, and that is why they were looking for massacring the Shia. This is the viewpoint of, unfortunately, such extremists among Muslims, if of course we may consider them as Muslims. So it is at least one of the possibilities that Sufyani holds the same viewpoint regarding the Shia. In his eyes too, Shia are a group of deviated Muslims, or rather disbelievers. They have brought innovations, bid'ahs in the religion, and they should be killed. This is one viewpoint. The other viewpoint is that, no, it might be that the Shi'i thought is one of the main obstacles against the benefits of the superpowers in the world. As we see nowadays, that the Shi'i thought, as it is preached by Islamic Republic of Iran, and alhamdulillah, it is spreading in many countries, it is against the benefits of some of the superpowers.
True.
So It might be said that maybe Sufyani is provoked by some of the superpowers. And of course, we had the same regarding ISIS as well. At least some of the leaders of ISIS were provoked by some of the superpowers of the world.
Yes, we'll discuss more about this topic after a short break. So, dear listeners, stay tuned for more interesting data about the certain sign of reborn that Sufyani. Because knowing about foes of Imam is equally important as we want to know about the Imam. Welcome back to The Last Savior. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. I am with Dr. Karimi, and we're talking about the goal of Sufyani, who is one of the certain signs of reappearance. What could be motivating him to kill Shias?
Regarding the second possibility that Sufyani is against the Shia because of the fact that some of the superpowers in the world, they will provoke him. It might not be a clear narration confirming that, but at least there is one narration which may confirm this theory. This narration is mursal, which means that it doesn't have the chain of the narration.
Okay.
And it means that it's not an authentic narration. But let me discuss about the content of the narration, which may give us at least
kind
a hint
of idea.
Regarding kind of the analysis of the uprising of Sufyani. In this narration, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam is quoted as saying, Sufyani, to fight the rulership of Khorasani, who is ruling over Iran, according to this narration,
okay.
He will go to Rome. And of course, Rome in such narration is referring to the Western countries.
All right.
To repel this Khorasani, he goes to Rome for attracting and gaining the help of such countries. And of course, the narrations continue to say that when he comes from there, he comes back as a Christian, like as he is carrying a cross around his neck.
Okay.
So if we accept this narration, we may agree that, Sufyani somehow is helped and supported and provoked by some of the Western
powers
countries,
of Rome,
some of the superpowers. And of course, the other main and goal of Sufyani is for sure to prevent from the worldwide uprising of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and may Allah hasten his
reappearance.
And we know that later we'll discuss about the course of the events. Finally, they will fight each other, the army of Sufyani and the army of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. A part of the army of Sufyani will be swallowed up in a region called Baida, and we have the concept of Khazf Baida as one of the signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and this Sufyani himself will be killed either by the Imam himself or one of the people in the army of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
We'll be back in a short break.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand year old
Welcome back. You're listening to The Last Savior. This is IRIB English Radio. I'm Zainab with Dr. Karimi, and we're talking about the certain signs of reappearance. One of them is the uprising of Sufyani, and we were talking about his goals. How he is going to stand against Imam? Can you give us some details?
We are talking about him coming from Sham, a region from Sham, either in today's Syria or Palestine and Jordan. But now the question is that how, first of all, because of the fact that he's in need of a great army.
Yes.
When we are talking about the fact that he's coming from Sham, now the question is that, is he going to gain power in Sham through a coup? Or no, for example, he will be elected as a leader like what we have today, the elections, I mean, based on the laws of that country, I mean, Sham. There are at least some evidence, some indications in the narrations that give us this conclusion that he is going to gain power through a coup, not through, I mean, kind of election or anything like that. There are some narrations which confirm that. And first of all, there are some narrations according to which Sofiani will fight other people who also try to gain power, and Sofiani will defeat them through the fighting, not okay. through the elections. There are some narrations, those who are interested can refer to Mu'jam Ahadith Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, volume 3, page 275. There is one authentic narration in this regard from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, according to which the Imam says, the first land which will be destroyed out of these fightings is Sham. Three flags will fight each other in Sham, meaning that three people are looking for power. And of course, all of them are against the Shia. None of them is with the truth. So one of them is the flag of a person called Ashab. The second is that of a person called Al-Abqa. And the third one is that of Sufyani. First of all, there is a fight between Sofiani and Abqa. They will fight each other. But Sofiani will kill him and his army. Then he will kill the third person, that is Ashab. So at least this narration can give us this conclusion that Sofiani is not going to gain power through a democratic way, through an all election. Right. No. So this is one narration, and this narration is quoted in Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, chapter 14, page 288, hadith number 67. The second narration, which also shows that Sofiani gains power through a coup, is the narration referring to his hidden life.
Okay.
Sofiani will lead a very secret life. So for sure, if he's going to gain power through a democratic way, he's not in need of such a life, I mean, in a secret way. Of course, before gaining the power. There is one narration according to which Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is quoted as saying, وَقَدْ بَلَغَ مِنْ خُبْثِهِ أَنَّهُ يَدْفُنُ أُمَّ وَلَدِ اللَّهِ وَهِيَ حَيَّ. Sufyani is so wicked that he will kill one of his wives, Umma Walad, who is the mother of one of his children, وَهِيَ حَيَّ, while she is still, I mean, alive. Why? مَخَافَةَ أَن تَدُلَّ لَهُ. Because Sofiani is afraid that she may tell the people where he is hiding.
Okay.
And so this narration, first of all, is telling us how wicked is he.
How cruel to
the
he is.
Exactly. To the extent that he is
he
ready to kill his
woman
wife.
Alive.
Because he's afraid that she may tell the people about the place that he is hiding. And second of all, another indication that he will gain power through a coup and not through a democratic way. This is in Kamaluddin, chapter 57, hadith number 10. And the last narration in this regard is the narration which talk about a chaotic situation at that time in Syria, in Sham.
Okay.
And of course, under such chaotic situation, we cannot expect any kind of election through which Sofiani is elected. For example, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is quoted as saying, addressing Jabir, that at that time, in that year, فَتِلْ كَسْتَنَا فِيهَا اِخْتِلَافٌ كَثِيرٌ فِي كُلِّ أَرْضٍ مِنْ نَاهِيَةِ الْمَغْرِبِ. In the West, including Sham and Syria, there would be much differences among the people, chaotic situation. So all these three narrations at least indicate that Sofiani will gain power through a coup.
What we have concluded so far is that Sofiani is going to be in a warlike situation. He's not gaining power through any democracy, through any kind of votes. He's having war, and we have talked about his wickedness, how cruel he is. So we talked about his cruelness, and may Allah's curse be on all the foes of Imam. Thank you so much, Dr. Karimi, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to The Last Savior from IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Saudi Arabia,
Part 1.
Saudi Arabia these days has made headlines in many parts of the world, from its domestic politics and relations with the U.S. to its ground and aerial attacks on Yemen. But one of these developments was very important and strange. Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was once the most trusted journalist of the royal family, went missing in a peculiar way. He entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, but never came out. After an hour, his fiancée, who was waiting outside, informed his colleagues at the Washington Post via social media. And after several days, Jamal Khashoggi grabbed the headlines across the world. The operation that was aimed at eliminating Khashoggi turned into the biggest scandal in Saudi history. But the point is that Saudi Arabia and Turkey have their stories connected to one another in a strange place, in Istanbul, or the ancient city of Constantinople, the capital city of the Ottoman Empire, which goes back to 100 years ago when the First World War ended, the Ottoman Empire collapsed and Saudi Arabia was born. Geographical maps have not remained unchanged. Today's borderlines between nations and regions have seen constant changes over the centuries. Some people have come, put a pen on the map, and changed the lines as they wished and thought it was better, placing people on each side of the borderlines, and stories after stories have unfolded. In the autumn of 1914, the world's big powers were engaged in a bloody conflict for months because some did not like the borderlines set on the map at that time and were seeking little changes to them. Groups of young people, some on board ships, trains, and cars, and some by bicycles and horses, and even on foot, were dispatched from across the world to the front lines that were supposed to change the future of geographical maps. A war that was supposed to be concluded in a short period of time was dragging on with no end in sight. Thank you. This is Sarajevo, a city whose strange events at the beginning of the 20th century decided the world's fate several decades later.